Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Paul Lawrence, a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers, and tonight's conversation is with Ray Kammer, Director, National Institute of Standards and Technology. Well, Ray, in this last segment, let's talk about the future. I'm wondering, what are some of the key issues that NIST will be facing in the future?
I think from a technical point of view, one of the really interesting ones is in the next 8 years, perhaps less, we're going to see the end of the electronics age. The feature size in electronics is coming very close at this point to the point where the phenomena that are exploited by electronics, which are bulk properties, will no longer exist. You'll get down to the point where you're having to manipulate individual atoms and molecules, and we're going to have to find other strategies. That's going to be an enormous change for all of us. I think nanotechnology, working with small feature sizes in other areas, exploiting mechanical and chemical phenomena is a big issue for us. E-commerce is going to grow by 2004, just business to business. Economists estimate that's going to be $3 trillion, which would make it 25% of the economy in that year. Today, it's not 1%, so that implies enormous changes for all of us. I think in healthcare, one of the extraordinary changes that's going to take place that through the ATP program NIST helped enable is genetic tests on a credit card-sized device. Right now, for the six or so genetic attributes that you can be tested for, you'd have to pay $1,200 to $1,500 for each attribute, which means you'd only do it if there was a family history, obviously, then it might be worth doing, but otherwise it wouldn't make sense. In the next, 6 or 7 years, credit card-shaped devices that fit in devices about the size of a normal PC are going to be available for testing many genetic attributes, and it will cost a few dollars a pop. This makes the possibility of routine screening of the entire population possible, which will have tremendous health effect benefits. It also has tremendous implications for ethics and things like that that are kind of hard, and privacy that are kind of hard to think through. But one of the most exciting changes I think our society will see in the next decade.
Well, let me ask a couple follow-up questions. You mentioned e-commerce, and so I'm wondering, what's NIST's role in e-commerce?
Well, I think we have three main roles: measurements and standards for electronic commerce, and what we provide there is measurements of interoperability. All the e-commerce services are not produced by one person, so the only way they can interoperate is if they're manufactured with hooks, at least, that are standard, some sort of application hooks that will allow them to interoperate with other services. And also, functionality is important. Computer security, for instance, people claim that they've just sold you software that provides computer security. Does it? We have test beds where you can test the functionality. Or indeed, the vendor can say, I tested this against the NIST test bed, and it does work. One piece of technology that we'll be putting out of our measurements and standards labs this summer is something called the Advanced Encryption Standard. Right now, the most widely used piece of encryption is the Data Encryption Standard, issued by the National Bureau of Standards, NIST precursor, 20 years ago. That's getting old. It's possible, and with great difficulty now, to exploit it. So we're putting out the next generation this summer, and we hope that that generation will last 30 years, but we'll see. It's hard to know what computers will do. We do some technology development through the Advanced Technology Program. For instance, we've funded the creation of an information infrastructure for healthcare, which is a very important area that isn't working very well now. And then finally, electronic commerce for smaller manufacturers. Through our manufacturing extension partnership with our 2,000 technology field agents, we're reaching out to the 400,000 small and medium-sized manufacturers and providing them with pieces of software and toolkits that they can use to become familiar with electronic commerce.
You just mentioned the credit card size device, which will enable genetic testing to be cheaper and, I'm assuming, faster. And you talked about how that would work, and you hinted at some of the ethical considerations around that. How does those type of questions play into what NIST does?
We try very hard to evaluate the implications of technology for society. Privacy is a big, big issue. In the case of the genetic testing, you can imagine models where your health insurer wants to screen you ahead of time in order to only pick healthy people or people without any genetic disposition towards expensive illnesses. I think our society is going to have to address that as a group, but that's definitely one of the implications of this technology. And I expect there'll be legislation conferring privacy and probably precluding the ability of people to screen by genetic dispositions.
And one of the most interesting trends in government is the use of public and private partnerships. And you mentioned ATP a couple times and talked about it, that it was created to accelerate the use of innovative technologies. And I'm wondering, how do you see these partnerships working in the future?
I think the most challenging part of creating these partnerships is the intellectual property. I made a fundamental decision for NIST that we were going to concede the intellectual property to the private partner because I believe it makes it more likely that it'll be exploited and developed than if the government holds it. But a lot of other federal agencies have not yet come to that same conclusion. And I've seen many other federal agencies where to have a cooperative agreement with the agency sometimes takes as long as a year or fails altogether. Because we don't need to debate intellectual property with people we collaborate with, we can sign agreements sometimes the same day that they're proposed.
Why do you think others have been reluctant to concede that?
I think that let's say that you co-fund some research with a private firm and you discover the cure for poverty. And then are you willing to take the heat as a federal manager for the fact that that's been conferred upon a private sector person rather than retained by the government? I would argue, yes, that's the appropriate way. That's our economic system, and that's the way it'll get exploited and made available to the rest of society. That's just how we work, but not everybody's comfortable with that.
And how about the future in terms of the leaders of NIST and the people who will be there? Do you see that changing?
I think our current generation of leadership was grown up almost exclusively from within the agency. When I became director, one of the things I did was recruit a very, very capable individual from IBM, from their research, it's a lady who has manufacturing experience and research experience, because I wanted a culture that was more industry-like, and I respect and admire the laboratories at IBM very highly, so I felt very comfortable recruiting from there.
And how about some advice for your successor?
I think the most important thing for a successor to learn is quickly learn how Washington works and how the political system works. Most people who come from outside the Washington environment don't learn that until they're almost ready to leave, and it's a terrible handicap.
In terms of getting?
The most important thing is to be able to persuade people in the Department of Commerce and OMB and on the Hill that the budget invested in NIST is well spent. In order to do that, you have to understand the programs, but you also have to understand your audience. They're mostly lawyers, some of them economists. There's one physicist in the House, and there's one physician in the Senate, I think. At least that I know, that are prepared to understand technical issues at a more sophisticated level. The rest are not. And they're actually a little intimidated by the technical issues. And if you can't explain things to them in a way they understand, they tend to just shut down.
This will seem to be an interesting paradox, because you've just spent earlier talking about how fast technology is, how increasingly complicated it is, and now you've warned that it's even the people who you have to explain it to don't quite understand it.
That's
a
challenge.
It would seem to be an interesting paradox for the next leaders.
That is definitely a challenge, and I spend a lot of my time representing the agency and seeking out people that are in a position to make decisions on us before there's an issue in front of them, and explaining to them in a low-key way when the stakes aren't high what we do and why we do it, so that when there is an important issue where the stakes perhaps are high, they've already developed a comfort factor.
Well, great. And I'm afraid we're out of time, so I want to thank you, Ray, for being with us tonight. Enjoyed our conversation very much. This has been the Business of Government Hour, Conversation with Government Leaders. I'm Paul Lawrence, a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers and the co-chair of the PricewaterhouseCoopers Endowment for the Business of Government. To learn more about the endowment's programs and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness, visit us on the web at endowment.pwcglobal.com. See you next week.